Great, thank you. Yesterday, please just stop me at any time, ask any questions. I have far more prepared than I can possibly get through anyway, so it doesn't matter to me how long we spend on any topic. Yesterday, we talked a bunch about looking for new fundamental forces of nature, but I ended by pointing out that anytime you had a new force, unless quantum field theory is wrong, it means there's some new particle transmitting that force, right? And then we could actually look for the more, let's say, particle effects of that. We can look for if that particle is actually producible, real, on shell. So I talked about radiating that particle in some lab experiment, and those are great experiments. But actually, there's a whole class of astrophysical objects which can be excellent radiators of any of these or many of these new particles that we've been talking about. So anytime you're thinking about looking for a new fundamental force, you also want to think about what are the astrophysical probes of that same particle. So whatever same particle would have been transmitting the force also could have some significant astrophysical consequences, as I'll show you in the first part. And in particular, why would you think that? If I have some star, what I'm going to tell you is that actually, in many cases over much of parameter space, the star shines very brightly in whatever your new particles are, which are transmitting this new fundamental force. That might seem really weird because these new fundamental forces were very, very weakly coupled, right? We were talking about things, maybe gravitational strength or axions or something, exceedingly weakly coupled to any of our standard model particles. So how could I possibly tell that some, distant star, how could it possibly be a relevant effect? But of course, that, let's say with our sun, it's dominantly radiating photons, right? But only from the very surface region. So all the little standard model photons are all coming out just from a thin part of the surface of the sun, right? People like to say it takes however many years, I forgot now, for a photon to get out from the center of the sun, whatever that even means. In any case, any photons or other standard model particles that are deep inside the sun are well trapped, right? They're scattering strongly. They interact so strongly that they can't get out. In fact, we often like to describe the star as sort of a big blanket, right? It's like a huge amount of insulating material. It keeps the core actually much hotter than the surface and things like that. It's very hard for standard model particles to get transported from the interior of the star. But you know what I'm going to say? By contrast, these very weakly coupled particles, they're happy to just fly out of potentially anywhere, all through the volume of the star. And that's why it could possibly be interesting. That's why, in fact, astrophysical objects can be a very interesting probe of these new particles or of these new forces. Because instead of just radiating from the thin layer on the surface, I could be radiating these new particles from anywhere in the whole volume. So I get some big enhancement of the volume over this surface, if you like, in which to radiate the particles, and that can compensate for the, in general, much weaker coupling of these new particles. Okay? And in particular, the idea would be something like, okay, there isn't just a sort of sitting population, usually, of these new particles in the star, but if I have some collision of nucleons or whatever it is in whatever standard model particles in the star, they might collide and maybe brem off an axion or brem off one of these new force carriers, okay? And then if that's very weakly coupled, it could leave the star. And then I would just, in order to figure out whether this is a relevant effect, I would just, to figure out the production of this, I would just want to integrate some n squared sigma v over the whole volume of the star, where this n is the number density of all these standard model particles, and the sigma v is the cross-section to produce one of my new particles, okay? So I just integrate up that production rate over the whole, and I get to integrate over the whole volume of the star to tell me how much of this new particle is produced. And you can see sort of immediately what I want then, and why astrophysical objects are good for this. I want a lot of stuff. I want, in particular, high densities of standard model things, and I'd like them also to be at high temperatures, so they're colliding a lot, okay? So there's a lot of interactions, a lot of potential to produce a lot of these new particles, okay? So that's the basic idea. That's what I'll look for, and that's why stars can be great laboratories for looking for these kind of new light particles. Is that clear so far? That's kind of the basic idea that I'll be talking about for a little while. Or sometimes it's not the full volume emission that matters. if here's my star, stars, many of these objects have a temperature and density profile where they're hotter and denser in the core. It could be that your new particle is so hot and so dense in the core that your new particle in some range of parameter space doesn't make it all the way out from the core. It is still trapped in the core. But the new particle might be radiated from some surface like this, okay? So maybe there's some interior axion sphere or whatever you want to call it, which is radiating your new particle. That can be the case too. But because it's closer into the center of the star, this surface, the surface for radiating axions or whatever it is much hotter, and also the star is probably denser there. And so it's going to radiate a lot more axions, you know, if it's radiating black body and axions, then let's say the surface of the star will. Okay? So that can also be a part of the effect. Okay, is that clear so far? Questions so far? All right. So there's many different kinds of astrophysical systems, many different kinds of stars people have considered for limiting all sorts of different kinds of models of new physics. Okay, the many different kinds of new forces I talked about last time, and even hidden sectors, you know, where you have a light sort of light dark matter particle with a new force carrier, et cetera, et cetera. If the new particle you're proposing is light enough to be produced in a star, then you probably should consider astrophysical bounds on it or astrophysical probes of it. And so there's been lots and lots of papers written. I couldn't possibly summarize the whole field. So I'll just cherry pick a few interesting examples related to some of the forces we talked about yesterday. So let me just give you a few examples of what kind of astrophysical objects could be interesting. So first, a white dwarf star. Just to remind you, a white dwarf star is about a solar mass in mass, but it's been crushed down until it's only about the Earth size or so, something like a 7,000 kilometer radius. So you've packed all that solar mass in very tight. In fact, as you know, to the electron degeneracy pressure limit, right? So that's a good candidate, you might think, because it's very dense, right? So it's what I want. Potentially, it's going to radiate a lot of my new particle if I can see throughout the whole volume of the star, right? And in fact, actually, its surface is not very big for radiating standard model photons. So it's not a great standard model photon radiator. But if I get to use all the particles in the star, I still get to use a whole solar mass of stuff, and I win by the n squared. So the white dwarf could be a really good object to look at and set some good astrophysical limits. And in particular, actually, maybe it's not surprising that the white dwarf is one of the best ways to limit a new particle like an axion coupling to electrons. Okay, maybe that's not surprising because it's, you know, it's sort of filled with electrons, as dense as you can get electrons to be. So that's going to be a good limit on a new particle or a new force coupling to electrons. So if you do that, so I should say first, sorry, the white dwarf can potentially produce a lot of axions. Of course, one downside of astrophysical sources is they're not, you know, precision-controlled experiments in the lab. I don't know exactly what's going on with them. So in most cases, we would use these astrophysical sources to set a bound on new particles or new forces. And the bound is usually roughly something like, if you radiate more energy in the new particles, then the star is radiating in all the standard model particles, whatever its dominant radiation mechanism is, then it's probably ruled out. Then it would have dramatically affected the structure of the object. So for different objects, I'm being sort of vague in general because this works somewhat different ways for different objects, but that's the rough idea you should have in mind, and then people set what's called a cooling bound, saying, okay, I would have radiated too much of this new particle and cooled off this object too quickly, okay? So for white dwarfs, for example, the best limit, it turns out, on the axion-electron coupling. So here I'm plotting again that axion-electron coupling, as we've mentioned a couple times, versus the mass of the axion. Here's that QCD axion line, like I think Alex was showing yesterday. And you can see, first, this blue region up here. Those are the new force limits on this. So again, like I said, if you have a new light particle, it's called an axion, pseudoscalar particle, that couples two electrons, it'll transmit a new force between matter. That was exactly what I showed you here. It's the same bound, okay? I've just translated into a different name for the coupling, but don't worry about that. So basically taking the same new force bound that comes from looking for new forces, that's here. But now you see there's something much better. You know, in fact, we didn't expect those new force experiments to see anything because already you can say, you know, it was already ruled out by many orders of magnitude because of cooling of white dwarfs, okay? And this, by the way, is so this whole green region of parameter space is ruled out because in that region you would have emitted axions so strongly from the white dwarf that it would have been, you know, dramatic, much more than the standard model emission. And this, by the way, is a fairly general feature. So this is in particular for this pseudoscalar coupling of the axion to electrons, but same for the spin-dependent force with nucleons. There it's not limited by a white dwarf. It's limited best, I think, by a supernova, as I'll show you. But in any case, it's a sort of common feature that these astrophysical bounds can be significantly stronger than, at least so far, our ability to look for new forces. Yes, please. Great question. Thank you. Yeah, very good. No, it's not obvious. And in fact, I haven't zoomed out enough to show you the... Oh, sorry. The question was, is it obvious why the white dwarf limit here is flat in the mass? That's a great question. And in fact, I should say, I haven't zoomed out far enough to show you. It does end, of course, at some point. The end point, you know for sure, the end points can be a little bit complicated, but you know for sure, you definitely cannot radiate an axion whose mass is much heavier than the temperature of the white dwarf. And in fact, I meant to say the temperatures of these white dwarfs can get up, I think, to something like 10 to the 7 Kelvin, which is something like KeV in energy. So there's no way, but you can see I only went up to an EV here on this plot. By the way, sorry, I made the plot, which is why it looks sort of blocky and not very pretty. But if I'd extended all the way up to a KeV, then you'd have seen, okay, this bound has to cut off because there's no way I can radiate, if the temperature is KeV, there's no way I can radiate a, you know, 30 KeV particle or something that'll be horribly Boltzmann suppressed and never be produced. So the bound definitely does cut off, but below that it's flat because since this temperature is KeV, all the physics, all the thermal collisions, et cetera, going on inside the white dwarf, they don't care whether your axion is, you know, 1 eV or 10 to the minus 8 eV. It's just massless as far as the temperature of a KeV is concerned. It's just super relativistic axions being radiated. So then it's completely independent of mass, basically, so long as the mass is well below the temperature. Did that answer the question? Yeah, great question. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, great. Okay, good. So I think that was what I wanted to say on that. So this is just kind of an illustration that we very often need to pay attention to these astrophysical bounds. So this is on this spin-dependent force coupling, but even if I went back here, this was on this scalar coupling, not spin-dependent coupling, if you remember this plot from yesterday in the alpha-lambda plane. This is looking at very weak forces around 1 times gravity, so there aren't astrophysical bounds down there, but I don't have to go too much farther up and to the left. I said there were other experiments, other plots looking up and to the left before I would hit an astrophysical bound on this kind of force as well. Okay, so it's something to just always keep in mind that when you're looking for new forces, for example, that these astrophysical bounds can be very strong. They can, in some models or some couplings, be much stronger than anything we can do in the lab. By the way, of course, I think it's very unlikely that this white dwarf bound will ever get much better. It's unlikely we're going to, you know, get precision understanding of white dwarfs and be able to, you know, understand a white dwarf and calculate everything so perfectly to 1% or something that we can bring this line down. Whereas, of course, as we know, there's sort of part of the reason we're here is that you know, high precision experiments in the lab can potentially improve by some orders of magnitude. So it's possible that these new force limits could come down, but of course in this particular case, with this particular coupling, they do have a long way to go to get better than astrophysics. Something else you might ask that people bring up though when looking for new forces in the lab is, well, wait a second. Is this sort of really a fair comparison? One is a very precise controlled experiment in the lab. The other is some horribly messy object out in the middle of space. I don't know that well. I don't know. Maybe is there some reason that this astrophysical bound doesn't apply? As I'll mention a few times, you certainly should always take the exact level, the exact, you know, low point here of the astrophysical bound with some grain of salt. There's surely some error in our understanding of a white dwarf. Much more so than in our understanding of those spin-polarized torsion pendulum or something, right? I mean, I think when they, you know, when you build your precision lab experiment, you really understand what went into it quite precisely. And when you set a bound from a precision lab experiment, you know, you can be sort of fairly confident that is the 2 sigma bound or whatever. With astrophysics, it's much more uncertain. That said, though, you know, look how many orders of magnitude this is. As I scale up the coupling, roughly, you know, it's going to radiate much, much more strongly. So you don't have to go too deep into these astrophysical bounds until, you know, if you tried to be even just a, sort of a couple orders of magnitude deep into the astrophysical bound, that model would generally, it depends on the bound, but would generally be very strongly ruled out by many orders of magnitude, sort of very unbelievable. I'll comment more on astrophysical uncertainties a little bit later. But there's another way to think about this as well. Okay, this is on sort of one particular, maybe the simplest model of a new force, but a star is a very different environment, and as you know, radiating from a star is a very different physics than looking for a new force. Am I really saying there's absolutely no way we could have seen a new spin-dependent force or any of these things that are ruled out by astrophysics? So people have sort of played these, let me call them model building games, myself included, to ask whether there are exceptions to these astrophysical bounds. I think the sort of short answer is you can. And by the way, this was sometimes motivated by anomalies. People would see some anomaly that looked like it was coming from some new physics model, but that was already ruled out by astrophysics, and then they'd ask, okay, are we really sure that the stars have ruled out all possible models? So some examples of things I'm aware of are, well, okay, the star really is a very different environment than on the Earth, right? In particular, the temperature and the density are much higher in the star than anything in our lab, thankfully. So maybe that really changes how much a particular model responds. In general, though, I think it is fairly sort of the general argument is it's generally fairly hard to evade these astrophysical bounds. It's true a star is a very different environment, but you know it's generally a pretty thermal environment. It's some hot thermal soup of stuff, and general stat-mech arguments mean it's going to be pretty hard to stop some new particle, if it couples at all, from being produced and radiated in this object. There's a couple examples though that I know that get around it, and they do it by, for example, this paper here was saying, well, actually, you know, I can make a somewhat more complicated model than just a single individual new weakly coupled particle. And if the coupling of that particle is environmentally dependent, if it's, for example, density dependent, so if it was smaller, if it coupled more weakly to the standard model at higher density, that, of course, would change the scaling. You know, the white dwarf is at very high density compared to, you know, where we do the new force limits in the lab, right? This is a solar mass packed into an Earth radius, so it's a much higher density, very different environment. So in principle, then, if the coupling is smaller, that you could evade astrophysical bounds. Or also, with some collaborators, I wrote a paper pointing out that also the mass could be density dependent. I'll say, though, my own work included, that I think this is generally quite hard to evade these astrophysical bounds, and these models are often either finely tuned or at least have, let's say, very carefully chosen parameters to get the physics we wanted out. So kind of my takeaway from doing this exercise was that although it is possible that we could maybe see a signal that looks like it's deep inside the astrophysical bounds, personally, sort of from my model building taste, seemed challenging. Let me leave it at that. Okay, so the astrophysical bounds are, in general, I think, something to take very seriously. Any questions so far, by the way? Okay.
There was a question from online that maybe fits very well here. What happens if the new physics couples for some reason only to second or third generation? How much do the bounds change or get weaker?
Second or third generation, you said?
Yeah.
Great question. Let me actually defer that for about 3 slides because I'm going to talk about that. Great question. Thank you. In general, quite a lot, possibly, right? Like, there's almost no second or third generation particles inside the white dwarf, standard model particles inside the white dwarf. But there is an exception, which I'll come to in just a few slides. Very good. Thank you. Okay, good. Great. Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Yes. The lower in what? Mass coupling? Is there like a lower edge to these?
Yeah.
No, the white dwarf really, for example, does not care if the thing is massless. It'd be happy to radiate it. So yeah, no, it can. It that's why it's just really completely flat. Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned the 10 to the minus 22 EV. So one thing to clarify, and I mean it's implied here, that this is not the dark matter.
It doesn't have
to be the dark matter. So it's independent of cosmological evolution. It's just that you have the particle in your theory. It will make the white dwarf cold. That's it.
Perfect. Yeah, thank you. That's very important. Just like new force limits, just as Mina says, the new forces and the astrophysical probes have this nice sort of advantage that if the particle's in the Lagrangian, it has to have this kind of effect. Yeah. One of the, like I said, there's lots of astrophysical bounds, lots of theories. I can't possibly talk about them all. But one of the most useful astrophysical objects we use to probe new physics is supernova 1987A. This is a great laboratory for new physics, as I'm going to tell you. What it was, supernova 1987A, was a type 2 core collapse supernova, so it was like a big supergiant star. And, you know, it ran out of pressure support or lost too much pressure support from running out of fuel and started to collapse. The core started to get crushed down to higher and higher densities, and eventually you form a core in this thing, which is sort of very roughly 10 kilometers big, which has achieved essentially neutron star nuclear densities. Okay. By the way, remember that a neutron star is also about 10 kilometers big. At that point, it's sort of crushed down so far, it bounces, kind of bounces off this core, and the outer envelope blows off. Okay, that's the supernova. But in particular, during this process, you get some very dense, very hot core. So that's what we're interested in, right? That's what makes for a good astrophysical probe of these new light particles. And let's see. Yes, just to show you that, because this is kind of important, the important part for us lasts a few seconds. Okay, so at about 1 second post-bounce, here's a plot of, for example, the temperature versus the radius from the center of the star, or the density versus the radius. And you can see, indeed, this gets up to really high temperatures, like 30 to 60 MeV temperatures, and also very high densities, right? So that's why we're so interested in it. You can see also that it's a pretty sharp function. So outside of like 15, this is a log plot and this is a linear plot. Outside of about 15 or so kilometers, the density and the temperature are really falling off quite rapidly. Okay, so it's really an object with a very strongly peaked, much hotter and denser in the core, and less as you go outside. Okay. So you might think this is an excellent laboratory for producing new light particles. In fact, it is. It's such an excellent laboratory that it also is a great way to produce the one particle of the standard model that sort of acts like this, that is so weakly coupled, the neutrino. And in fact, the supernova, we believe, shines more bright. Almost all of its energy is radiated in neutrinos rather than anything else. I think 99% or something like that of its energy is radiated in neutrinos for these same reasons. And they're all coming out of this tight, high-density core region. It gets hot enough and dense enough to really be a significant radiator of neutrinos. We usually say there's sort of a neutrino sphere also around this this radius from which your neutrinos are radiated. And indeed, the sort of what's so exciting about the particular supernova 1987A is that famously we saw about 25 or so neutrinos on Earth in our detectors that happened to be luckily operating at the time. We detected the neutrinos. And notice here, this is the energy of the neutrino versus the time it was observed in these different detectors. Notice we really were seeing the core of the supernova, right? It's pretty freaking cool. These are tens of MeV energy, right? So you're really seeing the neutrinos coming from, right in here, right in this core of the supernova, some neutrino sphere about here, radiating roughly thermally. Okay, so then we might also expect, though, that this could be a strong source of new, also, new, very weakly coupled particles. And in particular, famously, we place a cooling bound here by saying, well, look, we've really seen this burst, and we've seen that it lasted order 10-ish seconds. So if there was some new particle that carried away significantly more energy than the neutrinos, right, then it would have cooled this core in significantly faster than 10 seconds, roughly. And in particular, actually, what you really want is the new particle transfers energy from inside the neutrino sphere to outside the neutrino sphere. It's not even relevant that it totally escapes the gigantic envelope of the supernova. That's not relevant. So long as it brings energy from inside to outside the neutrino sphere, it would have messed up this data right here. Okay? So that's the... There's a lot more astrophysical details that one could go into, but in a very rough, crude sense, that's the bound, okay? Okay, so if I use that to place a bound, oh, sorry, yes?
One quick question I've always had about this is how... Like, is it really understood that we should see this gradient of neutrino events? But like, we see substantially more in this kind of 0 to 2 second region. Does that match up with our supernova models, or is this uncertainty significant in comparison to the modeling? Because how well do we think that this matches our models, and what does that tell us about how well our models match reality?
Good, great. So maybe I'll, you know, since I'm being recorded, I'll stick to more politic answers. But I would say, you know, I think it's fair to say nobody can simulate a supernova from first principles. You know, you don't write down Lagrangian standard model and then simulate the supernova from that, right? So it's very important to keep in mind. We absolutely make so by the way, I should have said these plots I was showing you here. I took them from my paper because we happen to have them, but they come from they're certainly not my work. They come from the group of Thomas Janka, who does some of the sort of, you know, more recent, most advanced supernova simulations. There's other groups around the world who do it too. You know, people worked very hard to put in as much physics as possible, but obviously it's a hard object to simulate. I think it's fair to say that certainly does some amount of fitting of the model or of the simulation to the data, right? That said, you know, we'll really only use the very rough parameters. I mean, you can see, even so, right, you know, we have about a factor of 2 spread in temperature here, for example. So we don't know the temperature to better than a factor of 2, but, you know, it really can't be very different than tens of MeV because we saw it. And I would say that, so absolutely, you know, there's... the model is fit to some extent, so I would never going to believe that, oh, you can say, oh, I can model this to 1%, and therefore, even if the, you know, at new luminosity, the axion is 1% of the luminosity of the supernova, I can rule it out. That I would never believe. But I think you can sort of trust the very crude features of the model. I think the crude features are, you know, reproducible. The fact that the neutrino, so, you know, roughly calculating the neutrino luminosity and figuring out that it gives you roughly 10 seconds of cooling time, yes, I think that's a pretty solid calculation. People argue about the exact details of exactly how it happens, and you may know actually our simulation, right? Famously, the have a problem right now restarting the shock in the simulation, so getting the supernova to fully blow up and things like that. That happens much farther out beyond the core, so it's not really relevant for anything, any of the bounds I'm going to talk about. But anyway, so but yes, there's certainly plenty of uncertainty, but that's why we'll put sort of fairly crude bounds. Was that addressing what you were asking, basically?
Yeah, that's very helpful. And I guess the duration, this 10 seconds, is also, like, at the order one level, the simulations give that.
Definitely, definitely, absolutely, yeah.
So maybe this is a bit of a smart-ass question, but if I asked you in 1986, if you have a supernova with 10 MeV, would you have been able to give me this duration and the... whatever, the number of neutrinos you expect 10 to the 54 ergs, I don't remember the full details. Or is it possible that, you know, like with the proton radius, there are these plots of like how as predictions got better, somehow measurements moved a bit? The other way around.
As measurements got better, predictions moved a bit?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great question. I mean, it's similar to the, it's a great question. To give you the smart ass answer, I was 6 in 1986, so I couldn't have told you anything. And also, I'm not a supernova simulator by any way, shape, or form, so I couldn't even, you know, tell you this now. But no, you certainly don't model supernovae from first principles. I don't know exactly how much was known before 1987. Like I said, that was pre-me. But I think you do get, let's say, rough orders of magnitude of things like the cooling time. are fairly robust. They don't take these extreme details of the simulations. The same simulations, that I think is not that's not a incredibly difficult thing to get to come out of the simulations is the rough cooling time and temperature and things like that. However, like I said, are the models adjusted to fit the data? I'm sure yes, for sure. So that's this is the usual astrophysical uncertainty, and this is why I say I would never want to trust these bounds to precision level, not to better than order one or something. But a calculation you can do that I have done myself even, so and I'm definitely not an astrophysicist, you know how much energy is released in the supernova, how much potential energy there was initially and things like that. You can just look at where it goes and get very roughly right orders of magnitude. So that's something that is pen and paper, doesn't need any simulation.
I guess you just answered my question, but I was just wondering, how do we know these are neutrinos and not some BSM things?
Say again, how do you know they were neutrinos and not?
Like, how you see some electrons or something, I guess, and then you say this is neutrinos that we saw?
Yeah, these were, let's say definition of neutrino in this case is whatever would be detected by these neutrino detectors. Exactly, that's right. So maybe you could come up with a model that fakes it, it's possible. But it's definitely not axions, for example. Like that would interact very differently. Exactly. Yeah, please.
You can distinguish if it's an electron antagonist, the signature would be inverse beta decay, which has a burst of energy and then capture of a neutron, right? So
you can distinguish the different kinds of neutrinos from each other, absolutely. That's for sure true.
It's also extremely difficult to fake inverse beta decay with any other BSM part.
You'll get no argument from me, but maybe a very creative model builder. And maybe if I put you this task by the end of the lecture, you'll have come up with... I believe in you. Okay. All right. Let me see. So yeah, great questions. Thank you. Yeah. Are you asking Maxime or the?
No. What I said is that electron antineutrino has a completely unique signature of positron plus neutron capture, right? And I would imagine that much of these events are actually electron antineutrino events because the cross section is much larger than just, say, scattering on the electron neutrino at these energies. Much larger. Orders of magnitude at least, right? So, but yeah. So with current detectors, I guess you can pick up just a regular electron scattering from electron antineutrino, and that's about it. Yeah.
And I do believe you get both from a supernova, although I actually claim to be an expert on supernovae. Okay, let me go on, make sure I said everything I want to say. So so you have this burst of neutrinos. I can set this cooling bound like I was discussing. So for example, for a nice recent paper that did this sort of most up-to-date that I know of, you can see this paper here. And again, so this is just the integral I was pointing out to you before, where this gamma is the production rate of axions, for example, times the energy of each axion, so you get the energy flux going out, and then cost yourself by this tau is the optical depth for, wherever I produce the axion inside the star, it has some probability to get out, this optical depth, okay? So there can be, depending on the coupling of the axion, there could be some trapped region where the axions really don't get out from, and they stream out from beyond that. The optical depth takes that into account. And you want to scan over all possible couplings, where sometimes you are or are not in the trapped region. Fast forwarding through a lot of important details, I'll refer you to the paper. Here are their results. So this is the luminosity in axions divided by the neutrino luminosity. So roughly above one is where anything above one is where I'd set the bound. And ignore the units. This is to the right is stronger coupling. So this is versus the coupling of the axion. Okay. And then, so you can see that at low coupling here, weak coupling, as I make the coupling stronger, of course, I emit more and more axions, and at some point I cross this line, so couplings above here or so would be ruled out by this supernova. I should say, by the way, this is the nucleon coupling. This is the axion coupling to n bar, you know, gamma mu, gamma 5n, coupling to nucleons. But then, and then it's exhibiting the behavior you'd at first think, that the stronger the coupling gets, of course, the more axions you radiate, you have a faster rate of producing these axions. But at some point, you know, it turns around and falls back off. And in fact, when the coupling gets really strong, you see you no longer have a bound. You're not radiating very many axions at all. And of course, that's because the axion is becoming so strongly coupled to standard model particles that it's really trapped. It's not making it out of the core of the supernova to cool off the core anymore, right? So it's acting more like a regular standard model particle, which doesn't transport heat very quickly because it has such a short mean free path. Or, for example, this is the plot here. Now this is stronger coupling going down versus the mass of the axion. And you can see this is the shape these bounds take. And that's why these bounds have a sort of top at stronger coupling, right, as well as a bottom at weaker coupling. So they just rule out a chunk of the space, not all coupling stronger than this, like the new force limits would. And one, people were already touching on it, but I want to make the point here again graphically. One really important point is all that you see all these different colored lines, those are different models for the supernova, different simulations for the supernova. They're not, by the way, exactly the same lines I had here because the simulation's done at different times. But either way, you know, these are different possible numerical simulations that give you different temperature and density profiles for the supernova. And you can see, you know, they produce some, you know, reasonable differences in the limit you get. I think, and this paper nicely did, look at a range of such models to try to parameterize your astrophysical theory uncertainty in setting such a bound, and then also then move to be, you know, if you want to set some sort of, I won't even say one sigma or two sigma because that's hard to say, you know, it's hard to say what the sigma is on a calculational uncertainty. But you should sort of set the most conservative bound you possibly can, so you don't, you know, take the bound all the way out here. You take the bound into this, you know, farthest in line, okay? Which is roughly what they did, and what people haven't always done that with astrophysical bounds, so you have to be a little careful, but I think it's what you always should do. Okay, so the questions we're already asking a lot about it, so I won't say more, but you really do want to keep in mind the significant uncertainty we have on understanding just exactly what these objects are, so therefore being able to set a bound like this, okay? Okay, so this is sort of the famous supernova 1987A bound on axions. You can also do the same paper did it on dark photons, on dark sectors, on millicharged particles, and so on. And you can set lots of cooling bounds like this. The question was asked before, so now I want to address it. We realized recently that, in fact, you could even bound. So this is mostly all these astrophysical bounds are on couplings to first generation particles. But as one example, we realized you could even bound the coupling to a second generation particle, to the muon, because it was realized, actually sort of surprisingly recently, that supernovae, in fact, have lots of muons inside of them. They're the, you know, the hottest astrophysical object we know about, so almost the only astrophysical object which does. But it's maybe not surprising. It's sort of surprising it was realized only recently, since the muon mass, let me remind you, is around 100 MeV, and these temperatures are, you know, a good fraction of 100 MeV, plus, by the way, these densities are so high that you get very high chemical potentials, which helps you produce even more. You really do have lots of muons in supernovae, okay? So here's the plot of the muon number density coming from these simulations versus radius. Let me say again, these are Thomas Janka's simulations. He's one of the people who pointed out that there should be muons in supernovae, and that in fact, incidentally, this is an important effect on the physics of the supernova and could be relevant, for example, to why previous simulations weren't finding a restart of the shock and the supernova to actually explode and things like that, since they didn't have the muon. Yes?
So the gradient in the density just comes from the gradient in the temperature at the center?
Yes, maybe is one way to say it, but also just because, like, I think the way the object formed by being crushed, essentially.
I see.
And the muon number densities is set not just, it's not just set by temperature, you really have to, the chemical potentials are large and a very important effect. So so the densities are very important, yeah. Good. Okay, so to make a long story short, then we said, okay, we can also put a bound, the same way the previous bound was bounding the axion coupling to nucleons, if I put a muon in here, have a coupling direct to muons, since there's a lot of muons in the supernovae, I can bound that too with the supernovae. Here's the result of our calculation. Here's the luminosity in axions versus coupling. This is now stronger coupling to the left. Sorry, I think I've picked almost all directions here. And this dashed line is the luminosity of the supernova, so anything above that roughly would be ruled out. You can see again, as you start from weak coupling, you go stronger. Indeed, your axion luminosity goes up and up and up until you hit these dashed lines. Again, these different lines are different simulations, right? That's where you enter the trapped regime, where the axions aren't making it all the way out. They have some axion sphere they're being radiated from. Well, I should say anything outside of the axion sphere, roughly, they're being radiated from, but your optical depth gets shorter than the core. And then you can see the luminosity falls off. Actually, as a technical point, these dashed lines show just the free streaming luminosity. They show just the luminosity from the part of the supernova that's outside of the axion sphere. You should also add the black body radiation from the axion sphere itself. That would only add to this luminosity and only make it more ruled out, as you can see. So we didn't bother. But in any case, so that shows you the sort of the cutoff between the free streaming and trapped regime. And then we can use that to set a bound here. This is on the axion muon coupling versus the axion mass, and we could set this much more stringent bound on the coupling of the axion to the muon than you had before. Because you actually had muons in supernovae. Yes? The cube, yes.
In these simulations, do you need some kind of ad hoc thing to get the kind of shock to restart, or do these explode on their own?
So I don't, really, if you want to know more about supernovae, you should ask someone who's more expert than me. My understanding is they, not yet, but that the muons seem to take it much closer to doing that, and that, so okay. This is really a detailed question because these supernovae are not simulated from first principles, as I understand it, okay? So you were always, I mean, it's just too many particles, too complicated to simulate from first principles, so you're always putting, you're always doing some amount of sort of effective field theory fudging over the microphysics, in that is the way I would describe what I've heard from the people who do the simulations. So those always came with some free parameters. But let's say within the range of uncertainty you believe those free parameters had for describing the macrophysics of the supernovae, then these are, you know, I think either some of these do explode or at least there's the possibility for explosion. So these certainly walked closer. But I think that's basically still a very active area of research. So I would not be the right person to ask. Good. Yes, any other questions about this? All right. So one last point I want to make, and then I want to just go to a totally, since they gave me the title Astrophysical Probes, I decided to reinterpret that broadly and talk about something else I was personally very interested in. But before I do, let me just point out the following, which is on any astrophysical bounds, for example, like here, inside this region of parameter space for this model, you're radiating so much axion that is brighter than the whole rest of the supernova, right? That's pretty amazing. That's a lot of axions, right? Even just outside of those bounds, you're still radiating a shitload of axions, right? Maybe it's not quite brighter than the supernova, so we can't officially call it ruled out or something, but it's a lot of axions, right? Or a lot of new particles. This is a general statement I'm making that applies to any of these astrophysical bounds, okay? So multiple groups now have pointed out in different models, in different parameter spaces like this, have pointed out that when you're somewhat near, but perhaps just within a few orders of magnitude of the astrophysical bound, there might be, perhaps even more excitingly, a way to actually look for it, although you can't rule it out from the supernova existing itself. You might be able to see the particles coming out. You might be able to see signatures or decays of the particles coming out. So that, I think, is a very interesting point that I won't even possibly try to summarize in the literature, but now multiple people have pointed out that, you know, when you're, just keep in mind, when you're close, but close might mean a few orders of magnitude of an astrophysical bound, it's a lot of particles coming out. So there might be, you might come up with an interesting signature you can see. So let me also throw that out to you, leave that as an open problem. Maybe you can, there have been some papers written along these lines, but I suspect there's more waiting to be written. I suspect there's more interesting signals. So far, people have focused on bounds, which is, in my point of view, maybe the most boring thing. And more interesting would be if we actually make a discovery. All right, so let me sort of leave you with that. Okay, so that was all I want to say about astrophysical probes as applied to new forces, about looking for new light particles. Okay, so important to keep them in mind. But since I was given the title Astrophysical Probes, and I don't really work on this stuff very much, I wanted to jump to something else that I've been just happened to learn about and gotten interested in very recently. Totally separate topic from this, nothing to do with this, okay? just because I think it's interesting, and it falls under the very general title of Astrophysical Probes. So the topic is, there have been a few papers recently pointing out that you can probe or set limits on primordial black holes from various astrophysical objects, but in particular, I'll talk about ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, okay, UFDs. So how does this work? First, let me tell you what an ultra-faint dwarf is, roughly. So we've observed these objects in the sky, where I have some roughly, you know, as we what we think they are, as we understand them, I have some relatively large dark matter halo, maybe about a kiloparsec in size, very roughly. But then I have a relatively much smaller cluster of stars, really this is the, when I say kiloparsec size, roughly the scale radius of the dark matter halo is about a kiloparsec, and the half-light radius of the stars is something like 30 parsecs or so, okay? So I have this small, fairly tight accumulation of stars in the center of this ultra-faint dwarf. Oh yeah, you can disconnect that, yeah. Yeah, totally separate topic. Nothing to do with what I've said before. Just because I've found it fascinating the last few weeks. I should say, this is not my work at all. There's a few papers on this, but for example, one of the earliest papers was by, a nice paper by Brandt in 2016. So that's the object. Now, how am I going to use this object, this astrophysical object, to say anything about primordial black holes, or how do they use it? I would explain the basic idea as follows. If there's the two different gases in this room, and there are different temperatures, then we know that so long as there is some coupling between them, right, they will equilibrate. The hotter one will start to transfer energy to the lower one, eventually, you know, get to the same temperature, right? Well, let me abuse language a little bit and say, I have two different gases here. I have the dark matter and the stars, and they're at different temperatures. Okay, they're not really thermalized, but it's the same physics. So maybe I'll put quotes around it or something. The temperature of the dark matter is, let me even put it roughly, is roughly set, of course, by the kinetic energy of the dark matter. 1/2 mv², right? Whereas the temperature of the stars is roughly set by the kinetic energy of the stars, 1/2 m^v² right? Then you can kind of see what I'm going to say. Even if these velocities are roughly about the same, if all the objects in this gravitationally bound system are moving at around the same velocity, because it's gravitationally bound, then if the mass of the primordial black hole, now you see why I'm talking about primordial black holes, if the mass of the primordial black hole is significantly bigger than one solar mass, then the dark matter is hotter than the stars, yeah? Even if you don't like the word temperature, certainly it will start to transfer energy at some rate to the stars, okay? So is that physics clear? So I like it sort of a cool effect. of course, you might think, well, maybe that energy transfer, I mean, generally in a galaxy, that energy transfer rate would be very, very slow. Very, very low, not relevant, for longer than the age of the universe or something. But the cool thing is, of course, these are coupled. They're coupled through gravity. And if I'm talking about primordial black holes, you know, they're heavy, they're massive, they're very dense. So they can actually have appreciable, non-negligible gravitational, Newtonian gravitational scattering off of stars, okay? which is kind of crazy. You can, you know, it's an old calculation. You can ask if I have two gases and they scatter off each other through a Coulomb force or through a whatever, 1/r potential, at what rate do they transfer heat between each other? So you can do that, you know, Coulomb scattering calculation. So I have my, you know, star, I have my little black hole. They come in, they scatter, they bounce off each other. I do my Coulomb scattering calculation. And then you can find that the heating rate for transferring heat from the primordial black holes to the stars goes roughly like this. Whoops. Where this U thermal is the thermal velocity, which is roughly the black hole squared of the sum of the squares of the black hole velocity and the stellar velocity. That's here, and the sigma naught comes from the Coulomb scattering calculation. Now I'm doing it with Newtonian gravity, so it goes like g squared. The mass of the black hole squared, right? This is the big factor we're winning right here. The fact that the black hole is so nice and heavy makes it really scatter quite a bit off of the stars. And then there's the usual, let me not write it, but there's the usual, if you're familiar with it, the log coming from Coulomb scattering. But don't worry about it. The log will just be about 10 or something. Yes? Well, the log would diverge, but yes, okay, yeah, that's true. There's it's the usual divergence of Coulombs, the log divergence of Coulomb scattering, but it's cut off by the fact, right, that, actually, it's cut off by things. It's cut off by somewhat, the cutoffs are actually a little bit complicated. I'm not entirely sure the previous literature has gotten them right, but it doesn't really matter because it's a log. But let me give you the following really crude cutoffs, which are already good enough, which are, it can't be bigger than a kiloparsec, right? And it can't be smaller than a star. And already that, you know, it's a log, so it's cut off. But yes, yeah, actually, that exactly, I'm giving you a somewhat simplified treatment. It's not exactly how it's done in the literature. But exactly what goes in the log, I think, has not been done maybe correctly. Anyway. So this is the heating rate per star, I should say. So energy transferred per time to each star. And just look at it for a second. First of all, this, you know, goes like you'd expect, makes total sense. It goes like the temperature difference between the two gases, right? It has, of course, the amount of primordial black holes you've got scattering off of your star. This would be true even if there's just a single star, right? So it doesn't have the number of stars in it. And it has this sigma naught, so it's set by the strength of the gravitational scattering, right? So it makes sense. Okay, the real way you would set these kind of limits is more complicated, but you can get it roughly order of magnitude right by the following really simple estimate, which is if I just take this heating rate per star and I divide by the kinetic energy of a star, 1/2 m star v star squared, then I get about the time constant of the heating, right? I get about the time to double the energy of the star. And you know, if that time constant is short, than the age of my object, which, by the way, these ultra-faint dwarfs are old. They're about the age of the universe, so that's one plus you have. You have a long time to wait. Helps you. So if this time constant comes out to be longer than the age of, or shorter than the age of the universe, then you're going to have a very significant effect of this heating, right? And in particular, then your stars aren't going to remain so nice and tightly compact in the center here, right? It's not exactly how that's done in the literature, but if I do that, if you just divide this heating rate formula by 1/2 m star v star squared, you'll see that the, so this is h over, oops, goes. Can you see it back here, hopefully?
It's on the big screen.
Oh, it's on the back. Okay, perfect. So this goes like g squared, energy density of the black holes, rho pbh, mass of the black holes, mpbh, over this U thermal cubed. Keep the log, although it doesn't matter much. Oops. So that's the time scale for heating, okay? If I divide the heating rate by the kinetic energy of the star. So that'll tell us, and it goes, you know, a lot like you'd expect. It goes like g squared for Coulomb scattering, goes like the energy density in the black holes, goes like the mass of the black holes, right? And crucially, like I said, that's where we're kind of getting all our power, because these are very heavy black holes. So they actually have reasonably strong Newtonian, and, you know, nice and compact and dense. So they have reasonably strong Newtonian scattering. And then you even get enhanced. I didn't say it, but the velocity of the black holes is actually a little bit, the velocity of the dark matter here is actually a little bit bigger than the stars, because the dark matter has got a larger halo. Okay, so is this clear so far? Is what I'm doing clear so far? Okay, so then turns out you can just go ahead and plug numbers directly into that. Okay, for the known ultra-faint dwarfs, for example, I think a common one that was a good one to use for this was a dwarf called Eridanus II. so if you just go ahead and plug in numbers. You'll find that this timescale is just about 10 billion years for mass of the black holes around 10 solar masses, and a density of the black holes, let me characterize the density in terms of what fraction of the dark matter are made up by the black holes, of order 1. So if all the dark matter mass is in black holes, then any black hole mass, you know, 10 solar masses or bigger, gives you a time constant around or smaller than the age of this object. Okay? Sorry, was there a question? Oh, sorry. In reality, that's my very, very crude, you know, for this board estimate of how you would derive this effect. In reality, what you really want to do is ask how this heat transfer rate affects the stars directly. So you would you have to write down some density distribution for the stars, calculate the potential energy in that density distribution, and then ask, okay, if I feed energy in, what's the new virialized shape the stars take on? You're not too surprised, though, that this is roughly right. that as they get heated, you know, they expand. And so after about this time scale, they will sort of have roughly, you know, doubled in size or something like that. Okay? In fact, actually, it's a slightly different power. I should say, too, so you can do that all analytically. Also, people have, although there are certainly, you know, I've made it sound too simple. I think there's plenty of astrophysical uncertainties with this. But people have also even done simulations of this kind of heating and indeed seen this effect. It actually scaled parametrically a little bit differently than you got analytically, which is a little bit worrying to me, but nevertheless, the answers are roughly the same. Indeed, when you do that more careful analysis, you find that you get essentially a bound, right, on the mass of the primordial black hole versus the fraction it makes up of dark matter. So if there's one, then anything above about 10 solar masses is ruled out, and there's some bound, you know, like this. Whereas you go to ever higher mass, since this is linear in both m and rho, as you go to ever higher masses, you bound ever smaller fractions of the dark matter. Okay, so is that clear? Any questions on that? Yes.
Yeah, the fact that you're only using gravitational interaction, does it mean you can put bounds on any dark matter candidates of your favorite?
Exactly, that's right, exactly. Anything above 10 solar masses. So long as it's tight and compact. It does have to be tight and compact. And that enters the log, actually, this cutoff. But exactly that's exactly what I find so fascinating about this, right? That here's a bound coming only from the gravitational interaction, right? And notice it's a time when the gravitational interaction cared about, or let's say the formation of this structure, of this gravitationally bound structure in the universe, cared about the particular microphysics, the individual mass of the dark matter particle, right? If you're familiar with the normal structure formation simulations, they normally don't care, right? I mean, you normally don't simulate, like when you simulate a galaxy, you certainly don't put in every WIMP. You certainly don't simulate, however many 100 GeV particles it would take to make up our Milky Way. Of course, you can't possibly do that, right? Okay. But that doesn't matter also because the formation of structure is roughly independent of the mass of the dark matter. I mean, there's the equivalence principle. A 100 GeV WIMP orbits the Milky Way or falls into the Milky Way in the same way that a 10 solar mass black hole falls into the Milky Way, right? So normally, almost all structure formation calculations are totally insensitive to the mass of the dark matter, sort of this general equivalence principle argument, if you like. But that's what I really like about this. The microphysics of this Coulomb scattering picked out, it really actually told you something about the mass of the dark matter, and in fact, indeed, ruled out any dark matter, up to the various astrophysical uncertainties with this, ruled out any dark matter, above, or at least 100% of dark matter above that mass.
Okay, that's very cool.
There's shot noise, right? So
there's, what'd you say?
There's shot noise. I mean, these bounds, for instance, are just subleading to bounds from just shot noise Lyman alpha, right? So the fact that dark matter is granular actually matters for structure formation because of shot noise.
There's definitely other bounds, for sure. Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
I'm also wondering if we have like wave-like dark matter, do we get coherent scattering?
Maybe it depends a little bit what you mean by that. So that might be a good thing to discuss. Like it's maybe a little bit of a nuanced question. So it might be a good thing to discuss after. What's the right thing to say? But you certainly, certainly you can treat, wave-like dark matter. It depends what you mean, I guess, by coherent, but you can certainly treat it as a classical field. It has its various, density profile that it has, and you certainly would scatter off of that. That's for sure true.
You mentioned, you can be anything as long as it's compact. Is the compactness the only place it enters into this calculation, is the Coulomb logarithm, is that correct? Assuming it doesn't tidally strip or anything like that, that's a separate thing, but the physical size of the object only enters into the Coulomb.
That's what I was going to say. Essentially, yes, unless there's other effects that happen, like tidal stripping or whatever it is. Right. Unless it's so big that it really matters, but you could be much bigger than a primordial black hole and still be okay, yeah. I think that was all I want to say. As someone said, there are plenty of other bounds. I just was particularly interested in this one recently because I thought it was fascinating and there may be a sort of... in fact, some people have even already thought about other different kinds of new physics, you can use this same sort of effect to look for, okay? Maybe with objects even different than ultra-faint dwarfs, for example. But I thought this was a fascinating thing to think about. So anyway, that was the last astrophysical probe I wanted to tell you about, just give you an example of some astrophysical probe which is not looking for ultralight and particles or new forces, because there's lots of such. But I couldn't possibly summarize the whole literature, so thank you.
Questions?
There was a quick question from online, maybe that I can repeat. Could there be some slowdown, referring to the cooling, the neutrino emission from the supernova 1987A? Could there be some slowdown in the transit, for example, due to some interactions of the neutrinos that could cause a spread in the neutrino delays? In that sense, the cooling could be faster, but we would see the neutrinos with some delay.
Sorry, could you say that again?
I think the question, the person could also mute himself. The question is basically, could we see the neutrinos with some slowdown due to some interactions of the neutrinos within the supernova itself or some?
If the neutrinos interacted, and got slowed down or something, could you see that? In principle, certainly yes. Anything that extended that 10-second timescale would be very visible. I guess I can't, off the top of my head, I'm not immediately aware of someone coming up with a reason or a model that they do slow down. Maxime maybe knows better.
If neutrinos are self-interacting and they interact further, much below, beyond the neutrino sphere, then one expects the delay, right, of the time of the emission. Oh, they're all crap.
Fair enough. Yeah, and maybe there would be other interactions with other particles too that could do it. I don't know.
I can go crazy.
So earlier I asked about 1986. I can also ask about something more recent. So there was this paper, I think, 3 years ago maybe ish by Barr and Kfir and I don't remember the third one, but I think there were three. That was posing the question of, are these bands like reliable at all? So just what's your opinion on it? I like to ask this.
That's a great question. I should say I don't really personally have an opinion on it. I'm really not expert enough to take it. The people to really have an opinion, the people I've talked to felt that, it's a very interesting paper. The people I've talked to felt that we probably had enough data though to rule out their alternative scenario at this point. But I think it definitely points to the real, there is real uncertainty with these astrophysical objects, like I tried to highlight. I think like some of these supernova simulators would say, at this point, I think there's even somewhat decent evidence that we've actually seen the neutron star remnant from supernova 1987A and things like that, that I think would, let me say, perhaps disfavor that alternative interpretation so that indeed the bounds would be, should be believable, should be taken as solid. But it is, I think all that, it's a really important thing to do is to ask, okay, how really sure are we of all these astrophysical objects? I think that was I think that was, many people who think about it think that's maybe a couple sigma stretch, but it wasn't 100 sigma stretch, right, to get to a place where actually these bounds were significantly weakened, yeah.
So maybe just to be sure, my understanding was that, white dwarfs, maybe you wouldn't trust the Moda 1, but the white dwarf is there. Right, for sure, right? I mean, it's not like there's a question of horizontal branch stars or whatever it is, right? So I was wondering, do you not see the supernovae as less reliable than other, specifically supernova 1987A, that's less reliable? Or are they all really, you say, there's this non-zero chance that I would say, not 95% confidence level that these bounds exist at all, even the more reliable ones like
what? I think that's what Kfir was saying, right?
No, I'm saying non-supernova bounds, the non- like white dwarfs, my intuition was that 95% level confidence, I can say this bound exists. Even if it's an order one mistake, it's still there.
Right. Exactly. As I tried to indicate where I think there, I think you could maybe argue about exactly where the level goes, but you can't push it up too much in coupling before you're really very strongly in conflict with the data. The supernova 1987A was this interesting extra case, as Kfir pointed out, but I think at that point that's been, let's say, reasonably disfavored. So not very likely to be true. But right, then it would really, significantly wipe out or change the bounds. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yes. Do you have any idea how the bound from supernova could improve if a supernova explodes in our galaxies?
How the bound?
How the bound could improve.
Oh, if a supernova explodes in our galaxy? Bound, yes. that's a great question. A couple things. Assuming, we have all our neutrino detectors on and carefully map it out, I think it's very nice. I don't know that, I don't know that it makes a dramatic improvement to the bounds. Although what I do know is that it would make quite a significant improvement. So I was mentioning, I've already lost the, how do I get this back? Oh, Okay, so anyway, I was mentioning outside of the, is there a way to put this on the screen or? Okay. Anyway, out, you know, the instead of a bound, when you're outside of that, when you're outside but near that bounded region, within a couple orders of magnitude, you could actually look for signals, which I find even more exciting than a bound. Exactly, right, so when I'm, I don't literally mean this particular plot, but when I'm near, in general, very supernova bounds for the different models, there people have pointed out for at least some of them, you know, a bunch of interesting signals you can look for. In fact, actually, I had a backup. Multiple people have pointed this out, but I just had a backup from my own work, but there's a lot of other people who pointed this out too. So for example, here's the supernova cooling bound, and we pointed out one particular set of physics. Don't worry about what the physics is, but you know, everything within this colored, so this is actually on the dark photon coupling versus mass, but anyway. everything within this colored region would actually be visible through different sets of signatures, looking at positrons or gamma rays and so on and so on. All those kind of signatures where you're actually looking for a positive signature of something instead of just it emitted more flux so it would have cooled the, you know, because we already got an order one idea of the neutrino cooling time, and we're not gonna, I'm not gonna believe anyway that we get precision modeling of the supernova, right? But for looking for signals though, if it's in our galaxy and it's on today when you know, Fermi's on or whatever, right, or all our new telescopes are on, I think you dramatically expand these kind of regions. You dramatically expand the detection regions. Which is even more exciting, I would say. So for those, having a supernova in our galaxy would be really exciting. And it's something, at least in our, we had a couple papers on this kind of, you know, looking to detect things that are near but not in the cooling bounds. I think we even tried to, I don't know if it's on here, I don't think it's on here, but we even tried to make guesses for how much you would expand if you got a supernova in our galaxy, just to be optimists. Yeah, great question.
I guess we should probably wrap up.
Yeah, let's thank Peter again. We come back 10 minutes.